Welcome to the From Surviving to Living Spotlight Series podcast. And today we're going to be talking about, I guess we haven't found a short way to say this yet, but really understanding that not everything that you're told growing up and people that you think are heroes are giving you all of the truth or the whole information. We all need to come to a point where we question things for ourselves. Doubting and questioning are not naughty words. They're not dirty words. And they actually lead to deeper understanding. They are opportunities for personal growth. I think that growing up, I was afraid of doubting. I thought it made me look weak or not perfect, right? And coming to learn not to run from doubts or stuff them down, but really address them and look for answers was a lot of personal growth for me. So we're going to talk about that today. And so before we do that, can you tell us who you are and where you're from?
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Yes.
My name is Matthew Emerson. I am originally from North St. Paul, Minnesota. Where am I from? Well, so I was a homeless youth from 18 to 22. At that time, everybody was telling me you need to get sober. And so I got sober at the age of 22. But nobody told me that I can't be a drug dealer. So I was a drug dealer for 3 years sober. And then I ended up with a 9.5 year prison sentence.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question before you get too much further. How old were you when you started drinking or drugs or anything like that, that you finally quit as a young adult?
Oh, the age of about 14, I started. I think it's important to back up in that context. So I was raised since I was 2 years old by a stepfather who is African-American, a black man. And so growing up, my mom was a Catholic school teacher. My father was a black man. I also visited my birth father for 1 hour every 2 weeks for my whole childhood, right? And so growing up, I was existing in this extremely structured, like Catholic school level environment and thriving. And while at home, we had this biracial family that was extremely significant and was very normal. It was very normal. And then as I got older, there were problems in society that occurred because of my biracial household as somebody that could easily appear as 100% white in society. And so that was one of the first things that I began searching to understand the reason behind incidents that would occur, microaggressions or full-blown, you know, oppressive actions in my existence. And that led to this extreme defiant perspective in the world that I exhibited and then masked through alcohol and marijuana through my teen years. It was challenging because it's one of those things that you really can't address until you have enough education to call things for what they are and then have enough lived experience to accept those things for what they are and then even go farther to be stable enough to really have those conversations not only with yourself but with your community and articulate those things and how they affected you. And so that kind of sparked this illicit use phase of my life at the age of 14. And then from there, I pretty much spiraled downhill and hit rock bottom when I was 22.
And I bet as a teen, everything you just described would have just been confusion and wanting answers, but not knowing where to get them. And this would have been very comforting. An escape. Addiction is an escape. So what made you decide to transition from being a user to dealer?
Well, so I love the question because I've never been asked that before. So drug use was an extreme experimental existence. And so I existed to experiment with a new type of marijuana, with snorting a Vicodin. Well, let's experiment with snorting a trazodone. Let's experiment with snorting some pill that you don't know what it is, you know? Let's experiment by snorting a methadone and see how that's different from ecstasy. And it was just this constant level of experimentation until I ended up in this field of extremely hard drugs like amphetamines, heroin, and crack cocaine. And so at that level, I pretty much like had hit the pinnacle of drug use. like when you use the quality versions of these drugs, there's really nothing more exciting or more better. Molbetta, like that's a Vietnamese like English slang that my friend I used to say, molbetta. And through that experience, I had a lot of really fun. I ended up living on some executive's yacht for a month. I ended up, actually, I slept in a clothing store across the street from this building back when this building was a Vietnamese grocery store. And I used to have to come over here. And I always tell the story how the first time I ever came in this building, the gentleman was like, get me a lemon. And so I went across the street and he gave me like $1.10 to go buy a lemon. So I come across the street, I buy a lemon, I come over and he goes, not the yellow lemon, the green one. It was like, all lemons are yellow. And it was one of my first questionings of like, what is life? Like, what is what I've been taught, how I've been educated, and how is it different in that context, right? Because it's like a lemon is yellow. We all know this, right? But in translation, a lemon can be green or yellow, or probably some other color that I can't think of right now.
Yeah. So you switched to dealing. Was that a financial choice?
No. So I ended up doing a 3-day DMT session where I smoked DMT for 3 days. I woke up the next day in Hennepin County Jail with my face on the Star Tribune. Because you can imagine, for fighting a bouncer who was haggling me for asking for change in front of their bar. I thought I had another felony. At this point, I had 2 felonies for really frivolous auto theft stuff that was like not even serious. I wasn't even intentionally, I was aiding and abetting. And so at this point, I had done 244 days of time in the county system. So that was like 244 days of jail, plus another 120 days of house arrest in Stevens Square. And I was finally free and for 30 days. And I did this amazing, crazy drug that took me through my past, present, and future. And I woke up with another felony. And not only another felony, a violent crime felony for fighting a bouncer, you know? And at that moment, I did 21 days or so in the Hennepin County Jail. And when I was free, I said, I am done. I do not want felonies anymore. I don't want. And I also wanted to know what else was out there other than drug use, because I had experienced drug use. I had experienced up, down, all around, every aspect of drug use. So I wanted to actually know what it meant to be sober. And so I ended up in a 28-day treatment in Stillwater. And on the 26th day of a 28-day treatment, me and my roommate were messing around, and he threw Parmesan cheese in my hair. And so I got up and slapped him with a piece of pizza. And I was kicked out after 26 days of sobriety, the longest sobriety I had since I was 7 days sober when I was 15. And I was terribly distraught because I had housing set up. I had everything set up. And of course, my childish 22-year-old self had to stay in my room with a piece of pizza in the chow hall. And he kind of sounded like Mickey Mouse when he was like, and I did get quite a bit of satisfaction from slapping him, but it put me back on a road. And so at that time, I ended up making it 8 days sober instead of 7. And that was on my own without anybody's help. And that was huge. And on the 8th day, I was struggling. I went to an AA meeting. I met a guy there that kind of knew one of my friends. We get into his car and he starts shooting up heroin, right? Driving away from the AA meeting. I end up relapsing. 4 weeks later, I finally had called another treatment center, did some things. You know, my mom talked to me about change or die, things like that. And I finally set myself up to go to another treatment center. I went to RS Eden on 14th in Portland. It's apparently one of the roughest places you can go to get sober.
I have some friends who have been over there, yeah.
And I ended up doing 5 months and 3 weeks there on a 6-month program. I was kicked out again, but I took my sobriety with me. And that was huge. And so now I was in the world. I was sober. I ended up sleeping on my dad's couch. My dad's mom, who had passed away, left me a little bit of money to get my stuff together. And it took about all that money just to get my license out of tickets, all of my, you know, legal stuff with my license in order. I had a driver's permit, and I was able to purchase a small car and get some insurance. And that was what my grandma's entire inheritance paid for.
That's still huge.
But it got me out of the jam. And my mom said, well, it's either now or never. It's now or never. So we might as well invest in you now. And if you flunk out, then you flunk out. But at least we didn't wait 10 years to find out you flunked out, right? And so I had a car. And then my stepdad got me a job at a truck wash in South St. Paul, which was great. And so I was asking myself, like, okay, how do I stay sober? How do I stay sober? Right? How do I stay sober? I'm like free. I have everything. God has blessed me with all this stuff. How do I stay sober? And so I called my one friend, Mo, because he's got this weed. And so I knew if I hung out with him, he wouldn't try and pass me the blunt, you know? And so I started hanging out with Mo because he's the only person I know that doesn't do hard drugs, right? And so I just hung out with him for a few months and we had amazing adventures. He was selling pot. I had a driver's license. It was easy. And he never offered me any weed. So it was about 2 months I was around him smoking pot and I hadn't smoked any. So then when somebody that was more friendly or wanted to give me some, I was like, no, I'm good, man. If I'm not smoking with Mo, I'm not going to smoke.
Yeah.
And that's how I ended up in this circle that I just realized, like, it wasn't intentional at all, but all the people that I knew from my drug using days that were sober, the only people I knew that would associate with me while I was a drug addict were sober drug dealers. Mm-hmm. And so I just started helping them with things. And then that led up to this huge thing where, like, I would help them and help them and help them. And next thing you know, I fell into the category of being a drug dealer.
How long did you do that for then, did you say?
2.5 years.
And so how did that come to an end for you? I'm assuming it was unexpected.
Right, right. Well, there's rules that you follow. And if you don't follow one of the rules, you go to jail. You know, it's pretty much, it was New Year's Eve, and I let my driver use meth while he was driving. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was on a 24-hour schedule, so I was, for 24 hours a day, I was in a vehicle distributing, and my driver, I let him use meth, and there you go. That's all it took. The police pulled us over at 83 miles an hour. They found $9,000 in my pocket and drugs. And all I had was the possession of drugs. So all I was charged with was possession. But possession of that amount led to a 9.5 year prison sentence.
And I'm sure that your previous felonies would have been taken into factor for sentencing?
That, and I was not in the Twin Cities. I was up in Stearn County. That's nice. They earned their name that day.
So then you're in prison and all of this is very different. How did your family feel about that? Because it sounds like the people who raised you, your mom and her husband, your stepfather, were good. Were they good, solid people? And what did this look like for you?
Well, I mean, the most significant figure related to my family was that there was never a point where they said they were disappointed in me, ever once. In this whole process, even when I was a drug addict sleeping with people for a place to stay, there was never one word of "we're disappointed," one word of "you need to do something." It was just like, well, we will do what we agree to do, and we won't do what we don't agree to do. And I never asked them really for anything. And yeah, I mean, I do think about the day I was sentenced to 9.5 years and my mom brought me to court and how difficult it would have been for her. And for me, it was just this motion that I chose to go through. I was either run or go to court. You know, I was like, I got two options. And I chose the latter, you know. But for her, it's just, you know, for how much work looking that she put into my life at the age of 24 when I went to prison. I said, I must have been in the pits for months.
Yeah. Did you know that was going to be your sentence?
No, so I did a straight plea, so the judge could have lowered the number, but chose not to based on the evidence that she had and what I was saying. She also accused me of
still using drugs. And I said to her in the courtroom, I said, I passed 54 drug tests this year. And she said, just because you passed drug tests doesn't mean you're using drugs. 9.5 years. I'm like, oh, whatever. Yeah. Anyway, that's judicial system. I got to trust it for what it's worth. I will say, so I went into college, or I mean, sorry, I went into prison with 12 college credits. And I came out with 87. And I facilitated 114 father support groups while I was there. And I also participated in 7 Christian music ministry services per week the entire time I was there.
Did you start to do that as soon as you arrived, or was there some time before you got into those things?
It took some time. I kind of had to prove myself to the system, not only proving myself to the administration who monitors inmates, but also to the inmates that facilitate and produce service in the chapel area, which is a sacred space.
So during all of those things, as you look at it now, what's your attitude as you look towards yourself? How do you think that you changed during that time doing these groups? And do you think prison, good or bad, affected you on the whole?
Well, I mean, when I first got there, I was caged into a single cage at the bottom of a 276 cage wall structure, and the fatality existed. For the first time in my life, I contemplated suicide just to be safe, just to be on the safe side. I just commit suicide, you know? No, seriously. And from that moment, I got locked into my cell. So from the first moment that door opened and I walked out and I looked down this tier, this corridor with these tables and these stainless steel phones and this guard desk and a door that goes to somewhere that you're never allowed to go through unless if there's a guard there to let you through it. The fatality of it is the way I describe it. I thought, well, yeah, drug dealing was a terrible idea. That's what I thought. And I thought, you know, I will never, ever do that again because I'm not willing to do it. It's a very fun career. I really considered it a career for myself. It was a great career, but it's not worth 9.5 years in prison. And I went into the sentencing structure because I had plenty of good lawyers and things like that. I even had a forensic specialist, which I didn't need. I went in thinking, well, if I could get under 5 years and then do 13 months in prison, I could have my friends still sell this and my other friends still that and just kind of keep the business afloat for 13 months while I'm incarcerated. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so thankful. And transparently, I'm thankful for the 9.5 year prison sentence. It was really like, okay, the gig is up. I know that this is the problem. And at the time, I still had the third degree felony assault on my record, which automatically left me at closed points. So therefore, I didn't qualify for early release. I didn't qualify for any programming. I didn't qualify to go build houses with anybody. I didn't qualify for any of the fun opportunities that actually exist in prison, as few and far between as they are. I can appreciate. And that's the moment I was like, never again.
Was there more that happened in prison, or was it beyond your release after that 9 years that you started to question, you know, because you were mentoring, I assume you had mentors and probably believed what they were saying like you were as a youth. Did that doubt that maybe everything I'm being told is not the case happen in prison or later?
Well, I mean, shortly after that, there was a spiral of negativity that then supported my proposition to never sell drugs again. And that was, I'm very technical. I'm a technical communicator. I took accounting when I was 18 and chemistry, you know, when I was a freshman at St. Thomas More in Kentucky. And so in my 24-hour lockdown intake facility cell, I roughly calculated all the money that I made in the 2.5-3 years that I was selling drugs. And so my gross profit or my gross sales was $5 million. Wow. In 2.5 years. And I did the math and it's like, wait a minute, I spend $30,000 a year on cigarettes. Because it wasn't just, so I was smoking three packs a day. I smoked so many cigarettes, my lung collapsed at the age of 23. And I think it was from the cigarettes. But buying my brother's cigarettes or my friend's cigarettes or whoever's cigarettes. My budget was $30,000 a year on cigarettes. It was $120,000 a year on mechanic car stuff. And I ended up realizing that my profit was only $456,000 of $5 million. So like I did all of this work, got a 10-year prison sentence and everything for $456,000 minus expenses, which was roughly $400,000. So it's like, so I did the math and then I added the 9.5-year prison sentence, 24 hours a day of time associated with the work. And so before the prison sentence, I was making $500 per hour of my work. And then after prison, I was making 5 cents an hour for work. Yes. And so I realized that the people that were giving me the drugs to sell, they knew this. They knew it. And they're at home with their families, right? And I'm the one that didn't tell on anyone or whatever you want to glorify. But it's not something that I, it's not some, it's a moment where I realized that these were people that were really mentoring me. Hey, come, you should buy a different car from us every week. You should, you know, do this or get your car fixed at this shop, which is my brother's shop, instead of saying like, hey, you should save every single dollar that you accumulate because this is not going to last long. And then I look back at some of the people in my life who said that. And I'm like, how do you let me sell drugs and buy drugs for me and then tell me that? Which means that you had so much wisdom about all of these things. You knew I was going to prison. So that, but yet you still wanted to support me in being a drug dealer and support me providing you with drugs for not only your habit, but also for your community. And I realized that like societal structurally standpoint, I mean, like this is really like black market stuff. And they really had no, ultimately their moral compass eliminated any opportunity for my personal growth.
It's using behavior. Even when you're not using drugs, you can have a using mentality. And it sounds like the people giving you the drugs were using you. They had a using mentality. And it wasn't to your benefit. It was to theirs. And so after you leave prison, what do you think was different for you this time other than this strong desire to never return that ultimately kept you from, because I hear about relapses all the time, right?
Well, prison and post-prison, sobriety had become such a part of my identity, you know, being a sober driver of lowriders, of Dodge Viper, you know, all types of fancy cars, because I was sober and I was all around a bunch of people, so I got fancy cars and stuff. Sobriety was part of my identity before I got to prison or the joint, you know? But moving from the joint on, it was, it took all 3 years. So I ended up doing 7 months in St. Cloud. And after 7 months, the reason why I was able to leave St. Cloud was because my mom got me a lawyer that reduced my third degree assault to a disorderly conduct because the 2.5-year probation sentence was served. That allowed my custody points to drop from 21 down. So then I was immediately shipped out to Moose Lake. And through that process,
well, as you're talking about all this, I'm just thinking, wow, you have great family members that were there to support you that are not using you. They're really investing in you. And I know that now you are investing in others, which is an about face, right?
Oh, okay. I picked up my train of thought. So going through St. Cloud, experiencing the men, right? I mean, had long conversations about transformation from day one because I was dreaming about transformation. And I think about in E-House, in the intake facility, there was a man whose name was the letter L. And L, he said, hey, Matt, I want you, he said, you're smart and stuff, you know? And so he used to have me, I used to count in my head 2 minutes while he would shadow box with himself to see if he could last 2 minutes in the ring.
He had so many creative ways to survive in a box. And I pray for this guy today. Like, I just pray so much on him. Like, he's just I want him to pull up in front of the studio in a Rolls Royce. Like, you wouldn't believe what happened. And one thing he had me do is, and this is one of my first assignments in my change life, is he said, I want you to calculate all the times that I've been in jail since I was 10 years old. And so on the back of a kite, which is a government form that you can't mail out, I started calculating from the age of 12 until today. And he was maybe, I was 26, 25 at the time when we were doing this, and he was maybe 27 or something. And from the age of 12 to the age of 27, L had spent a total of 11 months outside of prison.
Wow.
And it hurt me. It was like 1 month when he was 13. When he was 18, he got out for 2 months. And I listened to him, and going back to the people that govern our lives through influence and eldership, it was all of his mentors that were causing this to happen. Well, you need to go do this, or, oh, if this happens, I need your help and do this. And it was just so tragic. And this is like within my first short time entering the facility. And it really shaped my understanding of the men that I was going to be communicating with moving forward. Because you got to remember, before I came in there, for the last 3 years, the only sober people I could communicate with were extremely high-level drug dealers in this community that we have in Minnesota. And so I really didn't have much room for a lot of trickery or anything like that. And so as I was going through the incarceration, you know, I ended up in Moose Lake. And I started sharing with some of the Native brothers up there my father's stories that he told me about myself and how we're connected to Indigenous heritage. And I quickly realized that we are not associated with any Indigenous heritage, to the point where I had violated some of their conditions of existence in that space, right? And, you know, my dad has passed away, so it's not like he could have vouched for me, for lack of better terms. And that's really a tragedy. And it's a tragedy that my father told me these stories. Now, to be fair, my father said, if you go to prison, the natives will kill you, you know? And I went to a medium facility instead of a closed facility. But, you know, he did give me a fair statement, but it's just with him passed away, there was no identity of that heritage or that lineage was lost. And so that was one of the first aha moments, is like, okay, my father told me this thing. I shared exactly what he said to somebody else. And now this is causing me imminent danger. Now let's reevaluate, who is this adult male figure for this adult male in society? Why am I listening to my father? And this was my birth father, not my stepfather. Why am I listening to his narratives? Why am I perpetuating his narratives? Why did I do this? It's caused me great harm, you know? And that's really one of the first moments incarcerated that was revealing to me. And so I went out into the community within the 1,000 people in Moose Lake Prison. And I started seeking out what eldership was and how it operated in this 1,000-man operation. And I got to meet, just by looking and listening and observing, I had an opportunity in a closed setting to see different versions of elders firsthand all day, 24/7. And that really caused me to seek, what else is out in life? And that's how I ended up going to a father support group in prison. And it was led by Monty Ross, who I spoke to on the phone earlier today. I had the privilege of going out to Perkins with him for his first meal after 33 years in prison. Just like, hands down, I don't even care. Like, we got biscuits with chicken on them and gravy. It was so fun. It was just like the coolest thing ever. It's like, never can take that away. But so Monty and Leon Perry, they were running this father support group. And so I sat in this room, and it was 10 men. And I was definitely, I was 26, and I was, the baby in the room, you know? And they were going around, and one guy's like, well, I got 3 daughters. I love them very much. And I'm ready to go home. I'll pass. And the next guy, well, I have 1 daughter. I've never met her. I've always wondered who she was.
And then you got another guy, and he goes, well, I have two sons, and I got off the phone with one of them before I got down here. And then I goes to the next guy. And then Leon says, well, I have six children, and I had to raise them all from prison somehow. And I made sure that I saved up my 12 and a half cents an hour labor to make sure I sent the I bought uniforms every September and sent them a box of uniforms for their school so they all had clean uniform. And I had to figure out all this stuff from prison. And, you know, from listening to him, you could tell that prison was kind of just thrown at him. He was like, forget prison. I'm going to raise these babies of mine, you know? And I just like was so empowered by that. And then I really enjoyed some of Monty Ross's in those early experiences. He talked about ownership of our lives and ownership of our title as fathers in our children's life. And he would always say, hold your title. You know, you can only relinquish your title, meaning you have to surrender your title to lose your title. Nobody can take your title without you surrendering it or relinquishing it. And I thought about it. I'm like, okay, hold my title. I'm going to hold my title, you know? And I operated from that context inside prison throughout the next 24 months there. And then throughout the 6 months after that in the early release program, boot camp.
And what you say is super important. I was a parent, a mom in prison. I was very determined to be a mom, but I had to reevaluate my definition of parenthood, that it's not just, it includes financial provision, but it's not about being the only provider. It's not about just supervising them, right? Daycares can do that. Babysitters do that. In fact, the government can fund your children if you like, and you're still their parent. So what is genuine motherhood? And I began to recognize it's, number one, being a role. Someone my children would want to grow up to be like. I can have all the money in the world. I can spend all the time in the world with them. And if I'm not worth knowing, it's pointless. And so I began to work on that along with the others. And so it's not about freedom. It's about, like you have talked about, mentorship. It's about what's inside. And so you now do, in the community, correct me if I'm wrong, because David had told me this, is it sober housing or things like that? What is it that you're doing now?
Oh, my current.
Yes, please tell us about that.
Well, I will caveat this by saying there's a large part that we jump over from end of prison till now.
Well, we can talk about that too. Tell me everything that goes into how you got to where you are.
Well, so I came out of prison with 87 college credits. And I had been fighting with the TRIO program, and I'm going to name them by name on the podcast for a reason. Because they came in and they were like, hey, we want to help you get your degree and help you figure out all the little details that you can't figure out for yourself. And every time they came in, year after year, for 3 years straight, I went to their one seminar every year. I was like, help me. And I'd fill out all these paperwork and I'd send it to them and I would get no response. And so when I got out of prison, one of the first things that when I had some freedom on my intensive supervised release year of process, is I drove up to Lake Superior College, which is who was bringing the classes into Moose Lake and Lake Superior College in Duluth. And I went to the TRIO office and I put down paper, all my papers of all my stuff that I did. I mean, oh my gosh, I did 87 credits for goodness. And they took one look at it and they said, I think it's time for you to see the counselor upstairs. Like, what are you guys doing here? And I mean, I'm sure they function in other capacities. It was so frustrating. But so I went upstairs, and from there, it was quite a process, and I had to fight to get my associate's degree. And as soon as I got my associate's degree, my younger brother was about 23 or 24 and walked in the door like, well, we just got my bachelor's degree. And he's like, and I was like, oh, I got my associate. He was like, Matthew, you're nothing until you have your bachelor's degree. And so I went and got my bachelor's degree at Metro State. And in the meantime, when I got out of prison, it took me 30 days to get my first job. And in Moose Lake, I worked in the soap factory full-time while I went to school full-time, while I facilitated the father support group, and while I did 7 prison music ministry services a week. And so I knew I could take on a little extra. that time. So I ended up working at the medical device factory in Edina on the production level for 3 years. I never missed a day, which is a skill that I kind of took from the boot camp and early release process and how hard that was. And so I worked there, lived at my mom's, and then I volunteered on the weekend at Habitat for Humanity and this called Ready for Success, which they, so like it was the best volunteering ever. So it was me and four old black pastors, and we would measure people's necks and their arms and their waists, and we'd put new dress suits on them after they either got out of prison or got out of the Carlson Business School with a low income, you know. And it was just so cool to connect with people because it wasn't just prisoners, you know. I would get these young college students that just got their master's in business, and I'm fitting them in a suit and talking to them, and we're having a good time. And then I, you know, somebody from Teen Challenge comes in and he's like, I'm going to change my life. And now 5 years later, he is the executive director of some huge company, you know. And those experiences just kept going. It was just like so motivating to help people, right? And just to get to help people. And over at Habitat for Humanity, I worked at one of their warehouses. It was nice to just do some construction stuff. You know, it was very de-escalating to just work in material and structural stuff because I like looking at fancy stuff. And through that process, I ended up staying connected with some of the folks from incarceration. And there was a prison administrator who was a prisoner who did the communicated with the prison administration for 22 years. And I met up with him just to see him face to face because his door was right next to mine. And he even helped me edit some of my psychology correspondent classes from St. Cloud State University. So I was, Mr. Berber, be happy to see you. And he said, well, there's this meeting that I want to attend, but the work release facility won't allow me to go there for some reason. So I'd like to send you instead if you got time. And that's how I got connected to the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. And through that experience, I had the privilege of sitting around the table with maybe 50 community leaders. Our MC was Duwaba, for goodness sakes. I don't know what his last name is, but we told the new administration, the DOC, enough is enough. We're asking for you to decarcerate Minnesota. And I had a chance to share my personal experience with the administration there. And then I also shared an undergraduate proposal that I wrote while I was in prison with the Department of Corrections. And I said, hey, this is kind of one of my visions for what life could look like differently, because I thought about when I was in prison, how hard it was to get educated, how hard it was to like do everything right when there was like some guy trying to hustle you at the end of the block, you know, every day. And it was always somebody, you take one out, there's another one pop up there every single time, you know. And so through that experience, that proposal was then championed by the Department of Corrections that I wrote.
That's awesome.
And it was passed into law last year. And that is called MRRA, Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act.
Which I love, because if they implement it like they should, then my husband will come home in a year and a half instead of 7 years.
Well, and my whole premise was, if you remain nonviolent while you're incarcerated, which it's really simple enough if you put your mind to it. If somebody calls you the B word, you let it go and you use it as a motivator to even work harder on the positive things you're working on. And then two, obtain some type of accomplishment. And we really want to push guys that are struggling with GED. If there's something blocking you from your GED, let your needs be known. I don't care if we have 15 staff help you get that GED. If you can get it in 6 weeks, let's get it in 6 weeks and be done with it and move on with our lives. And I'm so, so passionate about that. Somehow we got to figure that out, because it's one of those places where people get stuck. And plus, really help expound and really reveal folks inside incarceration that have serious shortcomings. And we really want to support those people with shortcomings. So important to just support people with shortcomings. I mean, radical idea. Right. I mean, and so I'm super, like, that's one of my passions that I've been working on through this whole process, and kind of a vision that has came to fruition. Like you mentioned, it has not been implemented yet, but it's a very serious thing. And so with serious things, I support being very intentional and not making any egregious errors as we're implementing it, which is one of my favorite reasons to support it. not only that I had a big hand in creating it. I mean, there was other people's ideas that were similar that were also inputted. So I don't want to know. And I was thinking about that on the way here, is that there's no, there's nothing that one person has done. You know, there's always a story behind it. There's always 2,000 people behind everything that one person has done, always. And so, you know, I like to marvel in my participation to the MRA, but I have to recognize the DOC staff that were employed for 2 years to work at it, you know, and all these other people. But I do like to be a voice, right? Now, my current work, there was a meeting with the commissioner May 21st, 2021. Okay, so think about May 21st, 2021. That was 7 days before Minneapolis had a little tough time. So we had this meeting with the commissioner, and we were arguing and asking why we can't expand work release. And he said that there is a disproportionality that is just a reality. It's just a fact that people in the inner city and from poverty-filled neighborhoods would not qualify for work release that people from affluent communities or from the urban areas would qualify. So it would be, there would be a 77% disproportionality to the implementation of a 50% work release policy. And so my response to that wasn't, this isn't fair or anything like that. I was like, all right, well, I'll create the housing for them to get out. That was my solution, right? And so I found myself in some sweaty investment back room situation where these guys wanted to invest in slot machines in Wisconsin. And I said, why invest in slot machines in Wisconsin when we could provide more housing for people that need it? And the response was, is there money?
It's always money and property.
Cool. Yes, there's plenty. No, I didn't know, but yeah. I was like, you know.
Yes, there is. I'm going to think about it later.
And so that group ended up doing all the footwork. They researched the whole thing. They basically created this huge plan, and they offered it to me on a silver platter and was like, hey, we'll, you know, spend $1 million on housing. We'll do this if you are willing to take on the project. And so I did. And for the first year, I mainly focused on 18 to 24 year olds. And I had a 12 bedroom house in the heart of North Minneapolis with 18 to 24 year olds that were coming out of prison and had problematic substance uses and mental health issues. So as you can imagine, I felt like a circus exister for quite some time. I was going to detox every 3 days. There was a lot of slapping on the wrist involved, but I really enjoyed doing honest work with youth, like that really, like these dudes, like either their PO is taking advantage of them, their mom is taking advantage of them because of codependency, something's going on. And I just loved having those breakthroughs and the breakthrough. And I mean, even, and it's crazy because it's like you deal with this kid and he's been homeless forever and all these things. And then one day he's like, will you take me to my dad's house? And it's like this huge mansion on Maple Grove Lake, whatchamacallit. And it's like, what is going on here? And you could see it from a distance. You could see it from 100 feet, why he's in his situation and why. And for me, it's more about just being a supporter, being somebody that supports them, listens to them. And then I try and utilize my authority for sanction in a way that will actually create change. So for example, if housing isn't the issue, right? Well, then what is it that's going to motivate you to ending, you know, an extreme use? And I found that keeping people that are using hard drugs out of the house is rule number one. Because what'll happen is I'll bring five guys that are all trying to change their life, and I'll bring one guy that's like, I can sell all five of these guys drugs. And it's like, wait, get out. You know, and that's like respectfully, you can't stay here. You can't sell drugs here. And I remember the first guy that I brought in there. Yeah, he wanted to, he was trying to sell the guy drugs. He brought in Percocets back when that was a thing. And I was like, you can't, I have to leave their names out of it, but you can't sell drugs to the other residents. I'm sorry. And it was a new thing for them. Yeah. It was like, what? No, this is what I do, you know? And it's like, listen, man, I sell drugs. You can't do it here.
Yeah.
I know what selling drugs looks like. I'm not slow. You know, but tow your Cadillac out of the back because I know you're selling drugs, you know?
Yeah.
And it was such a time in my life. At the time I was working on a city councilman's reelection campaign, and I got to knock every door of part of the city and have real conversations with Minneapolis people that were concerned about things that happened in 2021, COVID, et cetera. And I got to have heartfelt conversations. And then, like, I remember, like, one young man, you know, he's talking about work and stuff like that. And I just had no answer for him. So I put him in the car and we drove around the north side and I pointed at the roofs. And I said, you see that roof? That roof needs to get replaced. You see that roof? That's a new roof. Do you see the difference? Well, I kind of see the difference. And by the end of the afternoon, he could tell the difference between a new roof and a broken roof. And it's like such a small thing.
Yeah.
But for a 19-year-old kid that's trying to get off drugs, just to have the skill, you know, he doesn't ever have to use it. But the joy and the professionalism that gets instilled in him is, and the fact that he was open to receive it too.
Yeah.
That was like a huge part of my work. And that was kind of like my integral kind of learning stage of this providing housing piece. And then from there, I transformed into having 26 beds instead of 12. So I did so well the first year, they grabbed an apartment building to add on to the experience. Mm-hmm. And at that point, now all of these external people you'd never heard of come out of the woodwork to communicate with you because you're competing in their industry. And a lot of that was like, not appetizing, because I'm just trying to like help people, you know, like, and the money isn't really there, but it was enough to like, you know, pay my mortgage and it was enough to pay for my insurance for my car. And, or at the time I had a pickup truck, just pay for stuff. These other people in the industry like started coming at me on all of these strategies on how you can be more of this or do more of that. And it was like, what is going on here? And I remember this one group, they wanted a contract with me and they offered me more to help them with this thing that the other company would. And I was like, well, sure, why not? You know? And so I sent two of my guys that were in my houses over to their program. And the next day they reported that I had bed bugs in my house and they took both the guys in the middle of the night and moved them to one of their houses. And it was like literally like a shady power money grab thing. And then I had to like have a meeting with all these representatives from Hennepin County and the Department of Corrections. I was like, everybody come to the house. There are no bed bugs. Please, everyone can come. Like, and I had to like go through this huge process. It was just insane. Like, I couldn't imagine. Like, I was just trying to help people, man. You know?
Yeah.
Like, could you imagine? I don't want to deal with corporate America. But the truth is that the more you help people, the more part of that system you're affecting. Mm. So my choice is like, so for example, I would fight with POs. I'd be like, you're not going to violate this dude because he is off of probation today and still hasn't completed treatment. He completed a treatment a year ago. So I don't know why you're trying to violate him. And the PO would argue with me. I would call a PO supervisor. They'd release him off of parole. And I'd help him get to his mom's house in Kentucky with his newborn child, which is where he should be instead of in a sober house, because he has a destiny that he has chosen as a young man. And we want to support that.
One of the first things I thought of, one of the first verses, and hopefully I can find it quickly, but you were talking about understanding what is true and which narratives and maybe questioning those things. And Jesus talked exactly about that to his disciples. And let's see if I can find it quickly. He says, and this is Mark chapter 4, verse 24, Jesus said to them, "Be careful what you are hearing. The measure of the thought and study you give to the truth you hear will be the measure of virtue and knowledge that comes back to you." And so the idea that be careful what you're accepting as truth and who you're listening to for that truth. And Jesus was saying, you might end up with nothing, even though you think you've been filled. So I'm just thinking about that discernment as you're talking. And you have invested a lot of yourself into providing real help to the people that you serve. And I'm really enjoying listening to you talk because I will benefit from MRA, hopefully. Well, I think that is probably the end of our time here, so I'm going to wrap it up. But I want to thank you again for being here and maybe have you back sometime as MRA is implemented. We can talk more about that, some of these other things that you're doing, because I'm enjoying hearing about it. And for everybody that's watching, if you like this episode, you can find more episodes like it on my website, hollybott.me. And thank you for being here with us.
Look for more episodes that inspire at hollybott.me. Until next time, remember, your story is never over. God's grace is always waiting to rewrite it. This is From Surviving to Living.